cooperatives as a formal entity might have emerged in the 1800s, but cooperation as a part of how society organizes itself is as old as human beings. The saying, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and it's all about just competition and survival of the fittest, that is not true. There's a lot of cooperation, symbiosis, altruism that exists, that so many species and the ecology depend on.
Hey everyone, it's Hildy, and this is the Creating the Future podcast. I'm glad you've joined us here today. This is a place for us to explore what really creates social change. And in today's world, there's perhaps no more important question we can be asking. What will actually create the healthy, joyful future we all want to live in? I'm so happy that Emily Cuano joined us for the podcast today. Emily is a founder and co-coordinator of the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, where they're focused on creating a just and sustainable future for all of us. She's also the co-director of the Wellspring Cooperative in Springfield, Massachusetts, where they're working to create a network of worker-owned companies in marginalized neighborhoods, providing employment and wealth creation opportunities for low-income residents of the city. Given the economic uncertainty of these current times and the massive economic disparity under which we're all operating, talking to Emily inspires me to imagine a more humane economic system. And so it is my joy to welcome Emily to the podcast today. Hello and welcome, Emily. It is so great to have you here on the podcast with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Could you share a little bit with our listeners about your story? What is it that led you to be so passionate about the work that you're doing?
That's a great question. I grew up in a family that was definitely aware of and concerned about social issues and social justice. So we had lots of those kind of conversations growing up. I also went to a Quaker school where social justice issues were very much front and center. At the same time, I grew up feeling very, very cynical. And so while I cared and I paid attention to these kind of issues, I also felt like the world is screwed up. It's always going to be screwed up, and there's nothing that I can do about it. And I'll try to be a good person. I'll try to be aware, but, you know, can't change anything. And when I was 18, I was on a program, a kind of an exchange program, and there was somebody else in that program who was so concerned about the problems of the world that he really was kind of unable to enjoy himself. And that was kind of an epiphany for me. And I felt like, well, look, if there's somebody who cares so much that he can't even really enjoy life, the least I can do is get off the sidelines and try. I feel like at heart, I'm still a pretty cynical person. I'm still not very optimistic of the long, long run of human beings, but you got to try. So that's really what got me actually active and engaged in social justice.
So talk a little bit about how that led into the work that you're currently doing.
Sure. My background in terms of education, I went to a very tiny liberal arts college called College of the Atlantic. There were only 120 students when I was there up in Bar Harbor, Maine. And there was only one degree on offer, which is a degree in human ecology. So I was very interested in how the various disciplines fit in together. And that's what human ecology is all about. And I came out of there feeling like there are a lot of different disciplines I feel like I can study on my own. But one area that I felt like I couldn't do that with was economics, and that economics is really an important thing to understand. So I went to graduate school at University of Massachusetts Amherst, which has one of the very few radical graduate programs in economics in the country. And while I was there, I became a member of the Center for Popular Economics, which is a collective of progressive to radical economists. And our mission was to help people better understand how the economy works or doesn't work, as the case may be. Eventually, I became the executive director of that organization and did a bunch of stuff in between, had various other positions, but came back to CPE. And during our strategic planning process, we realized that while we believe we do a bang-up job critiquing capitalism, we did a less good job helping people grapple with what's the alternative. And so we looked at solidarity economy as being a framework that was more promising. And that proved to be the case. So I got deeply involved in solidarity economy work. While I was there, we anchored the launch of the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network. So that was in 2007. So I've been in the solidarity economy space since before that, but formally with the formation of that network. So that really informs all of the work that I do. So my day job is I am the co-director of Wellspring Cooperative. We're a nonprofit working in the Lower Valley, sort of Springfield, Holyoke area of Western Massachusetts. And we started off really focused on worker co-op development. So worker co-ops being very, very core to a solidarity economy framework. But a few years ago, we broadened our mission to include solidarity economy initiatives. So it's no longer just, we still do co-op development, but we also do other solidarity economy initiatives. So I'm very fortunate in that I'm still involved in the national network, the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, and I'm working very locally, very concretely in Springfield and Holyoke. So that's a great stretch, being involved in broad national movement, big picture, system change, and also getting my hands dirty with the day-to-day, which I think is really healthy, right? To actually have to do the nitty-gritty.
To do both. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We can get so lost in the theory that we forget that it's what happens on the ground that matters.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about solidarity economy.
Sure. I'll give you my thumbnail definition. And I just want to say that this definition comes both out of the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network as well as RIPES. It's an acronym basically for the International Solidarity Economy Network. So RIPES did a 2-year international consultation to kind of create a shared understanding of what is a solidarity economy. And so this definition is drawing both from USCEN and this RIPES consultation. So number one, it is a framework. I wouldn't call it a theory. I would call it a framework. And it is a framework that connects up solidarity economy practices, as well as the people involved in promoting and organizing and practicing these different practices. Those practices align with solidarity economy values. Now, in the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, we talk about 5, but it'll look a little different in different communities, different parts of the world. The 5 values that we use are solidarity. So solidarity, cooperation, mutualism, et cetera. That's one. The second one is participatory democracy. So not only just voting once every maybe 4 years, but democracy in the workplace. So that's why we believe that worker ownership is the only way to bake in that ownership and control in the workplace, but also democracy in your communities. We support things like participatory budgeting, where communities have some say over how municipal budgets are allocated. So that's democracy. We talk about equity in all dimensions. So very much anti-oppression, whether it's race or class or gender. So in all dimensions. We talk about sustainability being a value. Probably don't have to explain that. The last value that we talk about is pluralism. And what that means is not a one-size-fits-all model. We believe that there are many paths to that more just, sustainable, democratic, equitable world. There are many paths. None of us has the whole truth or the right strategy model. Solidarity economy, therefore, is a very big tent. There are many tendencies, there are many different frameworks that fit under this broad, big tent of the solidarity economy. And in part, what the solidarity economy serves as is a way to bring them together and saying we're all pulling in the same direction. We might vehemently disagree about, do we need a completely planned economy or can markets be tamed and used? Or these kind of things could be passionately debated, but rather than attack each other, let's recognize we're all pulling in the same direction and however we can support each other. And let's let the experiments happen. And different things might work in different places and at different times, depending on the culture and the political, economic, historical moment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that pluralism thing is very important. So within the boundaries of solidarity economy and that value system, if you can buy into that, happy to say, yeah, sure, we would certainly embrace you as part of solidarity economy. The very last thing that I would say about solidarity economy is that all of this articulates a post-capitalist world. If you're working it within a solidarity economy framework, there has to be buy-in on that. Some people believe that we can get to that better world by reforming capitalism. And that's a position. I'm not going to throw stones. I don't agree. But if that's your position, then solidarity economy is not your space. We are very much committed for various reasons why we believe that some fundamental laws of motion and the logic of capitalism will never get us there, ever. So that's a really fundamental core thing about solidarity economy.
Thank you for that description. I can almost picture it as you're talking about it.
Yeah, and let me just say that it is also a global movement. I mentioned RIPES, but just some other indications. The UN has a task force on the solidarity economy.
Wow.
They recently issued a proclamation in support of solidarity economy. The International Labor Organization runs an annual Solidarity Economy Academy. The solidarity economy has been enshrined in two constitutions, Bolivia and Ecuador.
Wow.
And there are maybe a dozen countries that have national solidarity economy policy frameworks, which means that all across the board, all the departments should be supporting solidarity economy. So there's really a lot there.
It sounds like. Well, it leads me directly into the question at the core of the podcast here, which is, what is it that actually creates change? And it really sounds like so much of what this is about, what solidarity economy is about, is really about some of the factors that create change. When you see change happening, what do you see undergirding that change? What is it that actually helps to create change, those factors?
One big factor is just this very particular historic moment that we're in of convergent crises, right? We just, you know, got over the pandemic, face a possibility of more pandemics, how that shut down the global economy. There were all kinds of supply chain breakdowns. Things just ground to a halt. Businesses had to close. That was a real shock to the system and very alarming. And we should be prepared for that to happen again. Climate change, and actually beyond climate, the whole environmental deterioration and species extinction and the Anthropocene, the sixth great extinction, the last one being what wiped out the dinosaur. We also are seeing like this incredible political and social schism, like this polarization, extreme polarization. We see this, I used to say, slide towards fascism. I mean, to me, I really think we're in the thick of it. I mean, the moves that this administration is making, replacing all kinds of military personnel, replacing anybody who disagrees, banning the AP, shutting down freedom of the press, stripping all these government departments. This is all creating a creature, the entire government just being loyal.
Right.
And that is a really scary, really alarming thing. And at the same time, there's just growing inequality. And clearly, we have a system that is not meeting many people's basic needs. And there's a huge amount of alienation and dissatisfaction. So that convergence of all these crises leads to a shakeup of people's belief in the status quo. And there's a lot more openness to different ways of doing things. And solidarity economy being a very concrete, practical, we can point to many, many, many existing quote unquote alternatives, although some things are not alternatives. Some things are very mainstream and some are very old. In fact, many of the things that we would embrace are ancient, right? Cooperatives as a formal entity might have emerged in the 1800s, but cooperation as a part of how society organizes itself is as old as human beings. And not only human beings, but we know studying other ecological systems and other species that there's a lot of cooperation. So contrary to that nature red in tooth and claw, or the saying it's a dog-eat-dog world and it's all about just competition and survival of the fittest, that is not true. It exists, but it's far from the full story. There's a lot of cooperation, symbiosis, altruism that exists that so many species and the ecology depend on. So it's so important to try to think about a system, an economic system, but also a world grounded in those values as opposed to capitalism, which is really grounded in self-interest, calculations about the best benefit for the individual or self-interest, and competition and profit maximization. That's a toxic brew. And that's what we're really seeing in the kind of naked and brutal form of capitalism that we are living under now.
You're making me think of so many different things. The first thing that comes to my mind is so much of the work at Creating the Future is rooted in brain science. And we're so used to hearing about the fact that our first reaction sometimes is that fear reaction and that it can take over. And that's in that reactive part of the brain. But the other part that's in the reactive part of the brain is cooperation, is compassion, is connection. They've done studies where they go into a preschool, even just a daycare with toddlers. And what they find is that if one of the babies starts crying, the rest of them all start crying. It's not that they're in pain. It's that we are wired to connect to each other.
And so to me, it's
always fascinating how we're so conditioned by living in the current system that we live in to think that competition is the norm. And we're actually hardwired to connect to each other.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It's in that reactive part of the part of the brain that has no language, the part that's reflexive.
Right.
It's why when we're watching a movie, we feel what the person on the screen is feeling.
Uh-huh.
We cry when we watch a movie. And all of that is actually hardwired into that part of the brain that connects us. And it's a mammal thing. So as you mentioned, it's not just humans. It's all of us animals, at least in mammals.
Yeah, absolutely. So solidarity economy is all about recognizing, yes, there are those other aspects. As an economist, we talk about the central character that the theory is built around, because the economy is a story. It's a social creation. And so we have this guy, literally guy, homo economicus, economic man. And economic man is defined as being calculating, rational, self-interested, and always trying to get the biggest bang for their buck. And that is building out from that assumption of who we are as human beings. What is human nature? that drives like the logic of the invisible hand and how if everybody acts in their own self-interest, everything's going to equilibrate to the best possible outcome, highest benefit for everybody. I mean, we can see how flawed that analysis is, but that's the underpinning of capitalism. And so from the very get-go, as we're building a different economic system and world society, and a different culture, we have to accept that there is a homo economicus. I believe that's true. But there's also this other side of us that despite trying to be taught about self-interest and competition, it still is there. It's love, it's cooperation, it's mutualism, it's altruism, it's compassion. And trying to lift up our better angels and building an economy around that is what solidarity economy is all about.
We often talk about the fact that individuals will go where systems lead them. And the systems lead us to think that competition is reality. One of the observations that I've always made is that we humans only compete when we are forced to, that our natural inclination is to work together. And seen through that lens, you just notice how often competition arises because it is forced upon us.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I will say at the same time, I think we have to relearn the dynamics of cooperation. We really need to be able to communicate well. So I do a lot of the training in with our co-ops, and the success of the co-ops, I mean, one in particular, our greenhouse, I've been very involved in many aspects, including the training. And half the challenge has been technical stuff, how to grow the technology that we need, getting the balance of this, that, and the other, all that kind of stuff. But half the challenge has been people and really building that culture. So that's a really important piece in all kind of aspects of solidarity economy, whether it's a community land trust or social currencies or participatory budgeting or worker co-op or a food co-op or a housing co-op. I mean, if we believe that everybody should have a voice and we have collective governance, then learning how to govern collectively is challenging for us in our society. It's something that we've lost from a lot of the traditional forms of organizing our societies. Almost all societies, once upon a time, were governed more like that. And we have to really work at it now.
It's really fascinating as I'm thinking about all of the convergent crises that you talked about. We really are at a point where we know we need something different.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, it's because we don't have something different to go to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so much of what you're talking about is developing a different way of being. It really isn't just about the economy. We think about business. We think about money. What you're really talking about is a different way of being with each other.
That is absolutely right. I mean, the culture is so important, and the culture is how we are with each other. How do we treat each other? How do we see each other? I know that one of your questions is, what could people do? And I say, if there isn't some kind of solidarity economy initiative in your neck of the woods and you don't have the wherewithal to start one, at the very least, just being part of this culture, being a little kinder, a little bit more compassionate, a little bit more patient, a little bit more accepting of differences, differences in culture and communication, just personality differences. That's all part of that. And caring. That's all really, really fundamental to building a solidarity economy and something that we all can do. I will say this also, a piece of the solidarity economy that we really do consider an important economic activity is care work. So all that social reproduction, so having kids, raising kids, taking care of your elders, taking care of your neighbors, all that care work that even if it's not waged is really valuable and should be recognized as important, critical work and should be supported. through policy and with funding as well, like for childcare should be supported. So yeah, it is all about creating far beyond the economy as normally defined, and goes back to that original definition of the economy, which comes for the Greek of management of the household. So if you think of the household, it could be your family household, but it could also be your neighborhood household or your regional household, your national or international household. And how do you manage that? It really is way beyond a traditional, narrowly defined economy of business. Absolutely. So important. So important.
What have you seen, Emily? Can you give us some examples of where you've seen the shift happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, on a really big level, in terms of solidarity economy, I can say in 2007, solidarity economy was basically unheard of in the United States. So since then, now it's very well known in progressive circles, funding circles, investor circles. It's a framework whose time has come. There has definitely been a shift. It takes a long time just to introduce a new framework. But I feel like maybe how long has it been, do I think, since there was this kind of exponential and all of a sudden people were hearing it all around themselves. So that's a big picture change. There are discussions happening in investment circles and philanthropy circles, specifically about solidarity economy. I know that there are these legal transactional law outfits that are springing up, and there's an organization for legal or lawyers involved in solidarity economy. So it's just popping up all around. In terms of what's been hopeful, like on the ground, co-ops, worker co-ops for sure have seen, again, that kind of very fast increase in the number of co-ops. There's been a lot more investment. There have been cities that have invested. In Massachusetts, we were able to establish the Massachusetts Center for Employee Ownership that does support cooperative development, as well as ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans.
Are these starting out as co-ops or worker-owned, or are they evolving? They were the standard norm that we're used to and are shifting because of their desire to do so. What are you seeing more of?
I think there are more startup co-ops, than there are what we call either conversions or transition. So a conversion from basically a capitalist form of business. You have the owner and then you have workers. And if the owner is willing to sell the business to the workers, then that's a conversion, right? It converts into a co-op. So I would say a lot of the conversions are very impactful because you're taking a company, hopefully, that's very successful. The workers know what they're doing already. They've got it down. And then they're finding the wherewithal to buy out the owner. Often it's an owner who's heading towards retirement and they want to do right by their workers. And they also want to leave a legacy. They don't want to see the business go under, which is what happens with a lot of businesses where the owner is aging out. A lot of owners have unrealistic ideas about how easy and how much they can sell their business for. So it's a legacy protection. There are some tax benefits. And they're also doing right by their workers, if the workers are interested in this. So those can be really impactful in terms of the number of workers and also just they know what they're doing already. And startups, whether it's a co-op or whether it's a traditional business, startups are hard.
Startups are hard no matter what.
No matter what. I mean, the failure rate in the first 5 years is something like, depending on the study, 75-80%. Huge, huge percentage of them fail. So conversions are very, very promising. And we talk about the silver tsunami, which means that a whole lot of business, small business owners, they're boomer generation and they're approaching retirement. And a lot of them do not have a succession plan. And so at least being able to offer the model of selling to your workers is something that has gotten a lot of attention and resources are being put in that direction. So that's all very hopeful and inspiring. Also, community land trusts are seeing a really big uptick. So maybe for your listeners that aren't familiar with what is a community land trust, I'll do my best to provide a thumbnail. The community land trust takes the land and puts it into a trust. The trust holds it in perpetuity forever for the benefit of the community. The benefit could be affordable housing, and that is the most common way in which a community land trust works, is for affordable housing, but it is sometimes used for regenerative agriculture. And some community land trusts also have some commercial properties as well. So the community land trust owns the land and then is able to have some conditions about what gets built and the terms of that. So the classic example is a community land trust, say, leverages grants and other sources of funding to, say, develop housing that is affordable. And so people who otherwise couldn't afford a house are able to buy a house. But in exchange for that below market rate, they agree if they leave, they are not able to sell it at market rates. So if the housing market has appreciated and the market rate is twice as much, they can't do that. There's a formula where you can recapture your investment and you can capture some equity, some of that built equity, but you can make a killing, and that is to preserve the affordability. That's why it preserves it as permanently affordable. We are building in our neck of the woods, the Lower Valley Community Land Trust will leverage a CLT model to develop a local solidarity economy ecosystem. So yes, the affordable housing, yes, the regenerative food system, but also let's be very mindful of commercial spaces for our cooperative businesses. Let's also support other forms of production that might not be a business. How can people provide for themselves? The other aspect is creating a center for community production, which provides the tools and technology to do all of the above. And we're very, very, very excited about digital fabrication. So everybody knows 3D printers, but there are many others where you can take a computerized design and then the machinery, the technology is able to carry out those complicated designs. The potential of this field is just like really mind-blowing. It's like Star Trek replicator kind of mind-blowing. We're not there yet, but that's the trajectory. And it's important to build in the skills to ride that technological wave within the community. So there's a whole global fab lab movement. Very few of them are put into the service of the community, but that's what we want to do. And the final element, just getting back to the culture, is really centering the importance of culture. How are we building culture spaces to do that, to celebrate, to gather, to learn, and to connect, build that community, right? So that's our vision. And the work that I'm most excited about, because it pulls together all these different strands. So it's not a co-op here and a regenerative agriculture over there, right? It's like pulling it together and seeing it all work together as an ecosystem.
That's fascinating. It is absolutely fascinating. And I'm thinking about how those principles, you're pulling together all of the strands of what it is to be living a whole life.
Exactly.
And I'm just thinking about how those principles can apply to the work that typical nonprofits are doing in their communities. I am sure that part of the ecosystem that you're working within has nonprofits within it. And I'm curious what you're seeing in terms of applying these principles to the work that nonprofits are doing.
In my neck of the woods, a lot of the nonprofits are, this is generalization, but are either providing services, which are much needed, but it is also not involving people in solving their own problems. So very necessary, very important, but our piece of the work is trying to help people figure out how they can come together and collectively produce for themselves, meet their own needs. It might not even be physical needs. It might be mental health needs. The Surgeon General has said that, well, the old Surgeon General, I assume, has said that there is an epidemic of loneliness. Well, how do you solve loneliness? I mean, partly it's something that communities can engage in really straightforward ways. If we have spaces where people can connect, people will figure out their own ways, or with light support, people can figure out their own activities. It might be singing together. It might be dancing together. It might be talking groups. AA is something I love to talk about just as a model. This is a very loose framework of a model, and yet it has been replicated not only for alcoholics, but for all kinds of drugs and sex addiction, and I mean, you name it. There's AA comparable organizations. These are self-generated by people getting together and running the program with very few guidelines. That's the kind of thing that we're really interested in engaging in. So that's the kind of build side that we feel like is missing in a lot of nonprofits. The other big bucket that nonprofits are engaged in is the fight end, right? The resist end, fighting against injustices, trying to correct harmful policies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Again, very, 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 very important and critical. Absolutely. But that alone, without knowing what you're building towards, then you're just fighting against what exists. And there is a way in which you're going to just reproduce it, because you're just trying to fix the system that you're fighting. You're tweaking here and tweaking there, but you're not fundamentally transforming the system. So we have this whole process we've been working with since 2020 of resist and build, of really trying to align and connect up the resistance side of the work with the build side. A lot of the build work is nonprofit work. So community development corporations, for example, do a lot of that housing work. They do a lot of the small business development work. It tends to be pretty mainstream stuff. It's dominated by that. So absolutely, that would be part of the nonprofit world. But we're trying to bring in this different model into that build world. And also what we're trying to say, or have these discussions with the organizations that are really in resist mode, because that is an important way of building power and really building your base. But another way to build power, is to own stuff. You own property, you own land, you own business buildings, you own housing possibly, or you have a relationship with the homeowners, right, through a community land trust. That's power. So there are plenty of examples. I mean, a good one is the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston, which used eminent domain to gain ownership of, I don't remember how many blocks. It's quite a large area. They always have a seat at the table of economic development and community development. They always have a seat at the table. And they're not inserting themselves, but they own like this sizable amount of land right in the heart of the city. They have a relationship with the community, and they always have a seat at the table. So it's another way of building power. I think both are really important, and we shouldn't be fighting about this way or that way. They're complementary.
Yeah. I mean, some folks have to work within the system in order to build the new system.
Mm-hmm.
And we always see it as a continuum. It's not an either or of eliminating the problem versus aiming at what we do want. We can't have the world we do want unless we eliminate the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just fixating on, as you say, fighting against the thing that we don't want. It's not just staying in that, but it's understanding that we're fighting against this so that we can have the world that we do want.
Exactly. I mean, being in left progressive social movements for a long time, I often hear people say, we just don't know what we want. We don't have a vision. or we don't have a unified vision. I think it's true we don't have a unified vision, but I think we have a vision. I think the problem comes in wanting the unified vision, the one true path. I don't think we'll ever get that there. And that's where you get sectarianism and division and splits and splits and splits and the fratricide in the social movements. I often provide this metaphor, and it'll give you a sense of what I mean by we're not cohered yet. So the metaphor is about a caterpillar who, when it spins its chrysalis, its body breaks down into this nutrient-rich goop. And in that goop are these things called imaginal cells. And they have a different imagination, a different vision of what it could be. And it's such a different vision that it is, in fact, attacked by the vestiges of the immune system of the caterpillar. And they're killed. But some survive, and they start to recognize each other as having common cause, common vision. They start finding each other and clumping. And as they clump, they become more able to fend off the attacks of the immune system. And then they continue to clump, and they begin to specialize. So some become a wing, and some become a leg, and some become an eye, until it emerges as this completely different creature, the butterfly. And why I like this as a metaphor for the solidarity economy is there really is a very vast foundation. We're not starting from scratch. There's a vast foundation that we can build on. But right now, we are sundered from each other. We don't recognize each other as building towards the same thing or even the same direction. And so you have a co-op here, you have a credit union over there, you have a mutual insurance company over there, you have participatory budgeting over there, and they're all working really hard, doing wonderful work in their own silo. And part of solidarity economy is also bringing these different pieces to recognize that we're all pulling in the same direction. And our differences are things that we'll have to grapple with over time as we become more successful.
I'm so glad for this conversation, Emily. I'm wondering, as we're wrapping up here, if there is anything in particular you think that our listeners can do, something tangible that they can do right now that can start moving towards more of that. And I just love that word solidarity, solidarity between us humans. And how we be together. Is there anything that you would suggest that folks can take action on right now?
Well, I think I already covered just what you could do on a personal level with your family, your friends, your community, being a little kinder, a little bit more compassionate, a little bit more maybe open-minded, allowing for differences and not villainizing people, even though you might have some pretty strong disagreements. So that's all part of it. Other really concrete things. Most areas, there are credit unions. Credit unions, by definition, are a form of a financial cooperative. Join a credit union. Even if they kind of look pretty traditional, they might just look like a bank, but they are owned by their depositors. And collectively also, hopefully we can push those credit unions to maybe returning to a little bit more of their radical roots. Maybe there are other things like maybe there's a food co-op in your neighborhood. That's a possibility. If there are cooperative businesses, invest in those. Or if there's nothing in your neck of the woods, if you have a few spare dollars, there are various kinds of funds that invest in a solidarity economy and co-ops in particular. So that's always something you could do. You can invest. You could donate. And then there's a lot of just mutual aid stuff. A lot of that stuff we just do naturally. We help other people out, right? And so to the extent that we can build that muscle and maybe institutionalize it a little bit so that it's not just a one-on-one, I know so-and-so, I'm going to help them out because they're in trouble. There's lots of things, lots of mutual aid systems. There's offers and needs. There's time trade, lots of platforms to help with various kinds of connections. These are relatively easy things. We did such a simple little event at a shared use commercial kitchen, and we did a thing swap. And the invitation was just bring whatever no longer serves you and take whatever you need. And it was a beautiful event. We had so many people come and donate tons and tons of stuff, really some nice stuff. And then people were just so thrilled, like, really? I can just take this for free. People came in off the street. So that's just building that sense of we do have a lot of abundance. A lot of us have things that we no longer need. And then there are other people that may well really, really need and appreciate those things. So these are kind of simple things that you could do.
You're making me think that's the kind of thing that you could do in your neighborhood, doing that thing swap.
Exactly.
We talk at Creating the Future, we talk so much about the term collective enoughness, that together we have everything we need.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what the solidarity economy is all about. I'm so grateful for you taking the time with us today, Emily. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Of course, my pleasure. It was great to talk. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm so grateful to Emily for sharing her observations and experience with us. We're living in what many are talking about as end-stage capitalism, where everything that is harmful about capitalism is coming to a head. Emily reminds us that there's an alternative, and that the cooperative aspect of that alternative has been part of our history forever. That we're not merely that competitive homo economicus that is maximizing their own self-interest. We're also, by nature, cooperative. The principles of the solidarity economy are principles that have meaning for the vast majority of us. Cooperation, participation, sustainability, equity. It's not just about the money and finance. It's about how we be with each other, how we manage the collective household that is our planet. You can learn more about Emily's work at the podcast page for this episode. And of course, if this episode got you thinking, we hope you'll share this podcast with your friends and colleagues and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, you can learn more about Creating the Future's work at creatingthefuture.org. Thank you for being with us today and for wanting to create a better future for our world. We'll see you next time here at Creating the Future.